He says he's the most progressive candidate on the ballot to succeed Rick Scott as governor of Florida. This morning, Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum in studio and taking your calls about his campaign to lead the state. Good Thursday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, make sure to get the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead, a conversation with Democratic candidate for governor and Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum, all about his campaign, controversies on the trail, and why he believes he's the best choice to lead the Sunshine State. We want your calls right now. Get on the line at 549-2937. Then later, it's our own Jay Solomon with his take on those controversial Confederate monuments here in our area. Plus, we've got a look ahead to this weekend's Mandarin Arts Festival, its 50th anniversary here on the First Coast. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, he's the outgoing mayor of Tallahassee and one of four major candidates running to win the Democratic nomination to be governor of Florida. Andrew Gillum is embracing the Bernie Sanders progressive wing of the party, and he's been attracting large, enthusiastic crowds on the campaign trail. But there have been ongoing questions about a grand jury investigation into possible corruption at Tallahassee City Hall under his watch. Gillum himself has not been under investigation. Recent polls show most voters are still undecided on a candidate in both the Democratic and Republican parties for governor. Many still don't even know who the candidates are. So whoever's running, they'll have their work cut out for them to get their message out because the August 28th primary is coming up soon. We're hosting as many of the candidates for governor as we can book here on this program. And this morning, we're pleased to welcome outgoing Tallahassee mayor and candidate for Florida governor, Andrew Gillum, to the studio. Andrew Gillum, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much, Melissa, for having me.
Thanks for being here. Already getting lots of calls. What are your questions for Andrew Gillum, candidate for governor? He's running in the Democratic primary. Get on the line right now. 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, and we welcome your comments on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. We're getting them already. We'll get to those in a few moments. And as I mentioned, Andrew Gillum, four major candidates in the running for the Democratic gubernatorial nomination. You've staked out the progressive flank in this race, embracing the so-called Bernie Sanders wing of the party. You're saying you're the most progressive candidate running for governor. It would be a massive change from Rick Scott if you were elected. You're calling for things like universal health care and other progressive issues. Why do you think this is a winning strategy to take the governor's mansion in, what's admittedly a purple state, not a blue state, but a purple state?
Well, I'll tell you, I sort of describe myself as a candidate that is reflective of what the everyday experience is of people in this state. I was born in Miami-Dade to my mother, who growing up was a school bus driver, and my daddy, who was a construction worker. I'm one of seven kids, number five of seven, all boys and one girl, my baby sister, and the first of the seven to graduate from high school and the first to graduate from college. I know what it means to see intergenerational poverty interrupted at the hands of a good public education. So if the Bernie Sanders wing of the party means making sure that we have a good public education system for our kids, that we pay teachers what they're worth, that we have a governor who believes in science and understands the threat that global climate change and global warming present to our state, then I'll accept that.
And you're calling for Medicare for all, a $15 an hour minimum wage.
Absolutely.
An aggressive response to sea level rise in Florida, which has the most miles of coastal property of any state affected. If you're elected, how are you going to get this agenda through?
Yeah, well,
there's a conservative majority in the legislature.
Yeah, there's a conservative majority today, right? Because we suffer from the impacts of a situation in redistricting where elected officials are choosing their voters rather than the voters choosing their elected officials. I know we like to describe the state of Florida as purple, but the truth is that Democrats outnumber Republicans in this state by a few hundred thousand. There are more independents who lean Democratic than there are independents who lean Republican. The truth is that people in this state have been hurt these last 20 years by this administration and the Republican regime.
By GOP control of
Florida?
For
sure, for 20 years now, right? And so you've got
How have they been hurt?
Well, 46% of the people in this state say that they cannot make ends meet at the end of the month. They're working, many of them working harder than ever, and aren't able to earn a wage to take care of themselves and their families. We got teachers who are being called evil, schools that are being called failure factories. We're 37th in quality of education. We're in the bottom 10% when it comes to starting salaries for teachers. There's a real crisis out there, and a crisis of leadership, quite frankly. And I believe that we do deserve a governor who knows what it means to have to navigate that and can push for those kinds of, I think, thoughtful and common sense changes in the state capitol.
Why are you a better choice than the more centrist Gwen Graham, daughter of former Governor Bob Graham, or Philip Levine, the Miami Beach mayor? Both are much better funded candidates than you.
Yeah.
They'll have more money to beat to death other candidates like a drum in this primary. If they're nominated in the general, they're going to have more money to get up on television and take on the Republican nominee. Why are you a better choice than these other more centrist candidates?
Well, I'll say, as it relates to the general election, I think whoever the Democratic nominee will be ably funded. We've got a U.S. Senate race in this state that we've got to compete for. We'll have the resources we need to compete in the general election. As it relates to the primary, my opponents will need as much money as they can get, largely because I believe that we will have more people. Already, we've got over 20,000 contributions into our campaign. And frankly, we're running a grassroots effort. And to be honest, I've run every race that way.
You're getting a lot of enthusiasm from grassroots activists.
That's right.
And they see this issue that had dogged your tenure as Tallahassee mayor as a non-issue. They'll point out you've been cleared of all wrongdoing. Much of the party establishment, though, wrote your campaign off. Nearly a year ago when Tallahassee City Hall, you were the mayor, had been the focus of a public corruption investigation. There was a federal grand jury. They subpoenaed 5 years of city records related to development deals in the city. And your friend, a lobbyist and a political ally of yours, was caught up in this. The FBI wasn't investigating you personally. Still, though, say you're the nominee. Yeah. Whoever you're running against on the Republican side is going to charge you with being a corrupt candidate. So what's your response to all this?
Well, I will tell you, I mean, I've served and been elected now for 15 years. I got elected when I was 23 years old as the candidate.
You're 38 now, by the way. You're the youngest candidate running.
I am, but I'm also the most experienced candidate with over 15 years of public policy experience across the whole range of issues. And what I would say is that I want people to judge me from my record, right? I'm the mayor of a city that is the fastest growing economy in the state of Florida, 17th fastest growing per capita in the country. The crime rate in my city is the lowest it's been since 2006. We received a tech hire designation from the Obama administration for the work that we're doing to train this generation of young people for the technology related jobs that exist today. So what I would say, first of all, I would correct the record that at least so far as we've been able to tell, this investigation focuses around a particular elected official. And in this country, elected officials are elected by the people and they have to be removed by the people.
You're talking about the Tallahassee City Commissioner Scott Maddox. He was the only elected official named in the grand jury subpoenas, former chair of the Florida Democratic Party. He's run for a number of other offices. Is that who you're talking about?
Well, he's the one that's been named. And the truth is I think we have to be careful with how we describe a community and a city. Our city is not a corrupt place. We're one of the, there's a reason I chose Tallahassee as home to raise my three kids. My wife and I love it. I'm the mayor of that city. We are fast growing. And I already mentioned some of the other great accolades that I think make us a really great place to call home. And my biggest regret is that the decision making of a particular elected official now has the ability to stain the reputation of an entire city.
Maddox.
And what I'm going to do is push back on that, right? Is this to say who we truly are and what we truly represent.
Did you make mistakes?
Well, I would say
in the course of this whole affair?
Well, I would say I think I've been a trusting person. I trust the people generally around me. I think if I had it to
naive?
Do again, I don't know if it was naive. I think in the process of learning and growing, right, I think people don't expect their elected officials to be perfect. I'm not a perfect person, and I don't believe there are perfect people. But I will tell you this. I'm an ethical person. I'm a person who stands by my values and my belief system, and I absolutely got into elected office to serve, not to take, but to serve. And I think people will find that to be true if they look over the arc of my service over these last 15 years.
If you're the nominee, are you too liberal to be elected statewide in
No,
Florida?
I believe that my belief system is consistent with where the people of this state are. There are folks who right now are accessing their health care only through emergency rooms. For those of us who have health insurance, we're not sitting any better, quite frankly, because those folks who are accessing health care through emergency rooms, those premiums are being passed on year over year over year to those of us with insurance. Our refusal to expand Medicaid in this state to 1.5 million of the most medically needy people has cost this state last year alone $6 billion that we could have pulled down from the federal government that we didn't pull down because of an ideological bend that, in my opinion, does not serve the people of the state of Florida.
How will we pay for health care in Florida if you're elected?
Well, the first thing we'll do is we'll pull down the $6 billion that we should be bringing from Washington, D.C. to help to expand
under
Medicaid.
Under the Affordable Care Act,
the Medicaid expansion.
How do you get that through the legislature?
Well, I think we make the case to the legislature that it is in the best interest of the people of the state of Florida. The legislators also have an interest, which is they want to be able to bring back projects to their district. Well, if we're spending more and more of the state budget on health care costs while leaving the money that we could be pulling into this state to help free up some of the money in our state budget, then they can't get those desires of their heart and of their districts approved. The governor of the state also has line item veto. I think we've got to find areas where we can cooperate with each other. And where we can't cooperate, we have to be willing to negotiate.
You've been closely aligned with the Parkland students who've emerged as national figures in the push for gun reform in America.
Yeah.
Your thoughts on the legislation that Florida passed when it comes to the issue of gun safety?
Well, I'll tell you, I thought that it was woefully inadequate for the moment that we now find ourselves. I do think that it was a step, movement in the right direction. But the fact is that we still have not addressed high-capacity magazines. We still have not addressed strengthening the background checks, closing the gun show loophole, making sure that individuals with domestic violence records and histories aren't able to access these guns. And finally, I think we've got to address assault weapons. I do not believe that weapons of war should be on our city streets. If you want to shoot a high capacity weapon, you should join the military.
You want to ban?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Without apology. I mean, I think, and by the way, the majority of Floridians want to ban.
Okay. So then, as governor, how would you take on the NRA and its powerful Florida lobbyist, Marion Hammer, who would naturally be expected to fight you on that every step of the way?
Well, I'll tell you, they fought me before. They had me in court for 2 years in my community because we refused to repeal an ordinance which simply said you cannot shoot guns in city parks. That you cannot shoot guns in parks where our kids play and our families picnic. And in Marion Hammer's state of Florida, the Gunshine State, that's so radical a notion that they were able to take us to court, have me in court. The good news is we beat them at the circuit level and we beat them at the appellate level. But what we ultimately want to see is this law overturned as unconstitutional here in the state of Florida. So I guess what I would say to that is judge me by my history there. We beat them before and we can beat them again.
Let's go to some calls now for outgoing Tallahassee mayor and candidate for governor Andrew Gillum. What are your questions? 549-2937. Join the show right now. Let's begin with Mark in St. Augustine. Hi, Mark. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. I just have a question. You mentioned earlier about how sometimes elected officials may end up having a position that can kind of, I don't know, frame a stance on the part of the whole state. And I'm just kind of curious about your position as it relates to sanctuary cities, sanctuary states. And if you were governor, would you enforce and abide by the federal rules as far as illegal aliens are concerned, or would you be in favor of sanctuary status for those individuals?
Thanks, Mark. And let me just point out a guy running on the Republican side, House Speaker Richard Corcoran, has made that his signature issue in this race, or one of his big issues.
Yeah, well, we should at least consult the facts, which are there are no sanctuary cities in the state of Florida.
You dispute that idea?
Well, I dispute the categorization of sanctuary cities.
Why do you say that?
Well, because one, there is no legal definition for it. What we say in our community is that we're going to not be a city where we approach people of a darker hue and say, show me your papers. That is, I believe, is inconsistent with who we are as a country and as a community. If you break the law, you absolutely will pay the penalties of having broken the law. But what we will not be is, one, we're not going to call people illegals. That terminology is meant to strip people of their humanity. And what we're going to say in our community, and I think what we're saying in our state, is that, yes, we are for comprehensive immigration reform. There are 20 million people in the United States right now whose status is undocumented and uncertain. Are we going to push 20 million people out of the country, I think most of the agricultural business interests in this state will probably say no way. And the truth is that Washington, D.C. has no intention of really doing that. This is a red herring argument. And I think we've got to really be careful about this kind of divisive rhetoric.
All right. The fact-checking website PolitiFact, based over on the west coast of Florida, and I'm quoting here, whether Florida has sanctuary cities or not is not as settled as Andrew Gillum claims. And it goes on to talk about really what constitutes a sanctuary city and how there is a fluidity to this definition and unsettled legal challenges, making it hard to determine if Florida actually has sanctuary cities. So they take some issue with your stance on this. Well, are you fudging the issue?
No, I'm not at all. I mean, I think what we have to do, and just to back it up a moment, it's important that we say who we are as a country and who we are as a state. And I think who we are as a state is a state that does not go around telling people to produce your papers. And quite frankly, I'm African-American. If a law enforcement officer came up to me and said, produce your papers, I'm not quite sure what I would show them. I could show you my driver's license, but birth certificates and that kind of thing, I don't ride around with that, right? I have to call my mama and ask her to send me a copy probably. But that's not who we are. And quite frankly, that's out of concert with the law of this country and the law of this state. And so simply what I would say is we deserve comprehensive immigration reform in this country. We're not going to become a state where we are the show me your paper state, but we are going to become a state and continue to be a state where we follow the law, the laws of the state, follow the laws of the municipalities, and obviously follow the laws of the United States of America. That's what we've done here in the state of Florida. This issue that Richard Corcoran has raised is simply a red herring. I pointed out to Mr. Corcoran that he himself was born in Canada and probably spent more years in Canada than many of the Dreamers spent in their countries of origin before they were bought here. And just like him, they came here through no choice of their own, no decision of their own, but because their parents made a choice. And all I'm saying is that we have to have a very common sense and I think compassionate approach to this and not become the kind of state where we start to profile people based off the way they look in the language that they speak.
It's 549-2937. Lots of calls for Andrew Gillum as the Florida governor's race is already heating up. The primary is August 28th. Adam down at World Golf Village. Hello, Adam.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for taking my call, but I do have a question. Your message resonates with me. I just wanted to make that clear, but I do have a question. What do you plan on doing, or how do you appeal to those people that your message resonates with? However, they see you as a candidate who has these beliefs, but they don't think you can win.
Yeah.
Like they think maybe you might be too far out there, so they don't know if you're going to be able to pull out the victory.
Yeah.
What do you do in that sort of situation?
Yeah, thanks so much for the question, because I think that is the number one question that voters on the Democratic side have, is how do you win? And I just want to, again, consult the facts. For 20 years, Democrats have been losing in this state the race for governor. And I believe that we've been losing the race for governor because our voters have said when they have a choice between a real Republican and the fake one, they vote for the real one every time. And Democratic voters tend to stay home when they don't see themselves and their beliefs reflected, as well as independents. This state is almost a third independent, right? And so my belief around how we win is that we say who we are, we stand up for what we believe in, and that we don't make apologies for advocating for public education or climate change in an effort to address that or changing this economy so that people can work one job instead of two and three jobs just to make ends meet. I know what that feels like. I've lived that. I haven't read it in a briefing memo or talking points, but I know what it means to not just try to survive in this state, but what it means to thrive in the state of Florida. And that opportunity has to be available for all people. And so the way we're going to win, very simply, in November, is the candidate who wins is going to be the candidate who has the ability to turn out their voters. The Republicans who have run in this state have understood that for a long time. The conservative vote is about a point more in the midterms. And if a Democrat is competing in that environment, we've got to make sure that we have a nominee who has the ability to turn out more voters. And for us, that means more black voters, more brown voters, more young voters, more poor voters who see us as a real champion for their issues. And I believe of all the Democrats running that we offer the very best opportunity to do that. The truth is that for 20 years, we've done it the other way. My theory may not work, but you should rest assured in knowing that the theory on the other side absolutely does not work.
Do you plan to ride a wave of anger and frustration with the policies of the Trump administration in this state? Are you going to campaign against Donald Trump?
I mean, first of all, I think Donald Trump is woefully underprepared for the job that he holds. I find him to be completely frightening as our president. Nonetheless, he's the president. And we litigated that point in 2016. I'm going to run this race talking about the issues that impact the people here in the state of Florida. We're the ones, quite frankly, at the state level and at the local level. Politics is local. And people want to make sure that they have good education, that they have good health care, that they live in safe and good communities, that we have a state that is rising to our challenges, looking around the bend and trying to make the state of Florida, frankly, the leader. I'm sick of being behind. We're the third largest state in all of America. We're an adult state, and we've got to start making those kinds of decisions. That's what I believe that this race has to be run on. Donald Trump, again, is what he is and who he is. But the people of the state of Florida are concerned about how it is they're going to make ends meet.
Let's go to a few Facebook comments now. Here's one from John. Why does Andrew Gillum feel that Rick Scott is accountable for every action taken by agencies he runs, like the FIU bridge collapse in South Florida, but at the same time, he doesn't take responsibility for the corruption and FBI investigation in Tallahassee?
Well, as I said earlier on the FBI piece, that involves an elected official, and that elected official will have to be held accountable for his decisions and his actions. If it involved the agencies of our government, if it involved departments within our government, absolutely I would speak up and stand up to that. But I can't hold accountability for an individual elected official's decisions.
Marcellus writes on our Facebook page, when will felons in the state get a chance to get decent jobs? A judge this week has ruled that Florida has to reconstruct its program when it comes to the restoration of voting rights for felons. How would you address that as governor?
Well, the good news is, Marcella, is in this November, we have the opportunity to vote to enfranchise former felons, 1.7 million of them here in this state who don't have their rights. And if it passes, about a million folks will automatically be, again, having their civil rights restored. As it relates to jobs, because I think this is really important. You know, we talk about people being able to pull themselves up by the bootstrap. For former felons who have done their time, they paid their debt to society and are trying to reenter society, we've got to make sure that they have jobs and the opportunity to go to work and earn a living for themselves and for their families. In my city, I led the effort to ban the box. We don't ask about criminal background history unless answering yes to having had one is a disqualifier for the job. If it is not a disqualifier, we're going to measure you on your merit. Are you qualified? Will you be a good employee? Will you contribute mightily to this organization? And what we have found is that those employees are some of the hardest working people we find in our government because they know what it means to be without. We've got to restructure the system to make sure that those folks get opportunities too.
You'd want automatic restoration of voting rights.
Well, that's what will pass.
If we get
60% of the vote.
For the ballot amendment.
Absolutely. It's polling above that right now.
Okay. Lisa tweets the show, does Andrew Gillum agree with the massive budget cuts to environmental agencies under the Scott administration?
No, of course I don't. I think it's been a true dereliction of duty. And I've called the governor out for being an election year environmentalist. Now he has suddenly come to the place
because
where he wants to
fund.
Because
he's running for Senate, most likely.
Well, for sure. And unfortunately, listen, this is a primal issue of concern for all Floridians. We live on a peninsula where we're surrounded by water on three sides of this state, and to believe that we would ignore the environmental changes that are confronting this state. We've got algae blooms flowing out of the east and the west side of this state of guacamole content because of the nitrate levels that are flowing into our groundwater and corrupting our system. Listen, the environment is non-renewable, right? This is the thing we've got to take the most care of, because once you lose it, you don't get that back. And I believe we've got to fully fund our efforts to clean the Everglades, to take care of the issues around Lake Okeechobee, but to also deal with the rampant development happening and the lessening of our public lands in this state, frankly, because we've been negligent when
Would
it comes to protecting the environment.
Would you place new restrictions on coastal development, given that sea level rise is expected to radically impact the value of those properties?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've got it. This is a really difficult issue, and I think it's going to require Floridians to have to reckon with this, both at the local levels, by the way, who have jurisdiction around development, but also at the state level. And we know that it's already approaching an insurance crisis where you can't get many of these homes insured.
Would you say no more building on the coast?
No, I mean, I think we've got to take a reasonable approach here. And part of it is that there are going to be areas that, quite frankly, are going to be more threatened and more susceptible to the threats of climate change and global warming and sea level rise and others. And I think we've got to have a difficult conversation about, again, whether or not development can continue in some of those areas. Where it can, obviously, we want to be able to promote that as an important part of our state. Where it can't, we're going to have to do some land buybacks. We're going to have to purchase up some real estate.
How will that be paid for?
Well, I mean, I think we've got a number of Forever Florida funds. We've got environmental funds that I think will be appropriate places to go to when it comes to purchasing some of those delicate and sensitive lands.
One more call. Let's go to Chuck at the beaches. Chuck, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, Chuck.
How are you doing today?
I'm excellent,
really,
man. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Sorry for the little delay here. I'm using my car phone. I am parked, though.
Okay. Go ahead, Chuck.
What I was wondering is, I liked a lot of what you said with a lot of things. I'm probably a conservative liberal, if that's such a thing. But the hard part for me with a lot of people right now is the gun issues.
Yeah.
And only because I don't think a lot of people are very educated with the gun issues, such as I hear people say, restrict large capacity magazines. As a person that owns several guns, when I go to the range, it takes time to load them up. You shoot them, you're done, you go home, you clean everything, you put it away, and you store it. I don't really think the problem is the magazines or the weapon. I think the problem is the people doing it. If you look at it from a user's point of view, such as myself, I have had guns my entire life. My grandfather had guns. My father had guns. I have guns. My brother has guns. We've had them all our lives. We've never hurt anyone with them. We've never been hurt by them. But yet, I've lost 3 family members to people drinking and driving. And I never hear a politician say, let's put regulators on cars so they can't go over 55 miles an hour. Let's put something on a car so that if you are drunk, the car won't even start. Nobody says anything like that. And if you really, really want to save lives, do something like that. Make it a law so people can't text and drive. Your phone knows if it's going over 10 miles an hour. If it's going over 10 miles an hour, it shouldn't
work.
Okay,
Chuck. Yeah, I get your point. Thanks for the call, Chuck. We're just running a little tight on time. Thanks for that call, Chuck. Andrew Dillon.
Yeah, so Chuck, I mean, I respect the fact that probably you and your family are responsible gun owners, and my issue is not with gun ownership in and of itself. But I think we got to really level with ourselves. If people get in cars with the intention to go and snuff out the lives of 17 people, that's a real problem, and we got to look more deeply at what that means.
There have been people, particularly in Europe, who've weaponized vehicles that way.
There are folks who have weaponized vehicles, but let's deal with what we are dealing with here in this country, which is the instrumentalities, the type of weapon absolutely does matter. We know that the AR-15 has become the weapon of choice of the latest mass shootings that we've experienced in this country. And the truth is I know that I've got friends that shoot high capacity magazines on ranges and otherwise.
Are you a gun owner?
I'm not a gun owner. My wife, unfortunately, wouldn't let me in the house with it. And I understand. I've shot a gun before. I mean, I've been to a range before. But the truth is these weapons, like the ones used at Sandy Hook, like the ones used at Las Vegas, like the one used, obviously, as Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, are extremely, extremely dangerous and have the ability to snuff out the lives of 17, 49 individuals. In the case of Sandy Hook, 20 into kids, babies. And I'm sorry, I just can't supplement somebody's individual enjoyment with that. However law-abiding they may be, as each of these individuals were law-abiding before they became murderers and mass murderers. We've got to deal with the instruments. We've got to deal with these weapons. And I think this is just a point where we may disagree there.
Here's an interesting question for you. It's on our Facebook page. Victor writes, will you bring back film and TV production incentives for Florida?
Yes.
Georgia is winning billions of dollars in revenue on these movie productions that used to be shot here in Florida.
Yeah, it drives me crazy to see films in other states that are manufactured to look like they're in Florida when you can come to Florida yourself and shoot a film.
I mean, there was one, this Ben Affleck movie that they shot up in Brunswick, Georgia, but it was supposed to be set in Ybor City, Tampa.
Yes. I mean, it blows your mind, right? And by the way, these are actually really good jobs for the state of Florida. They've got, I understand, a 2-year backlog in Georgia when it comes to some of these big blockbuster films that we could be bringing here to the state of Florida. This is contract work. These are makeup artists and engineers and set designers and costume designers. Those are good jobs that pay good wages. It has the ability to stimulate this state's economy. I think it was foolish for us to get rid of it. I think we ought to bring them back.
The idea, I guess, for getting rid of those incentives is the governor, I guess, didn't feel it was a worthwhile investment. Unnecessary expenditure. You would disagree.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think it probably had more to do with politics, the liberal left of Hollywood and the fact that they don't support in many ways the governor and the governor's agenda. That being said, what we've got to be willing to do, and again, I may be progressive, but I want you to know I'm no ideologue. What I am, and you can judge me by my record in the city of Tallahassee, we're not the fastest growing economy in the state for no reason. We didn't get a tech hire designation for no reason. We didn't recruit companies like Danfoss Tober Corp that are paying on average $50,000 a job, leaning into the future of this economy for no reason. But we need a governor, in my opinion, who is willing to break with ideological regime and is willing to govern in a manner that is commonsensical and, quite frankly, in the best interest of the people of the state of Florida. That's what I'm interested in doing, and that's what I believe I'd bring to the office of governor.
Here's another tweet for you. How would a future Governor Gillum create a bicycle and pedestrian infrastructure for Florida? That sort of brings in a larger point about infrastructure in the state overall.
Yeah, I tell you, first of all, we've got some of the best bikes and trails. We actually call it Trailahassee. So I want to just put a plug in for the capital city of Florida. But the Facebook poster's point is very accurate. We're a huge state. We've got some of the best vistas around. We have got to invest more deeply into bikes and trails. But to your larger point, we've got to address in 21st century transportation. We had an opportunity during the Obama administration to pull out $1.3 billion to help build high-speed rail across the I-4 corridor, the fastest growing corridor in this state. And quite frankly, you've got the population centers between St. Pete and Tampa and Orlando, and obviously moving downstate. We've got to lean into the future of transportation in this state. Asphalt will not build us out of gridlock and out of congestion on our roadways. We've got to start leaning into the future of transportation in this state. And you find a Governor Gillum who's supportive of investing in more public infrastructure there.
Governor Scott turned down the light rail money. He said there wouldn't be enough return on that expenditure.
Well, I think it's short-sighted. The truth is we subsidize cars on roads every single day. The amount that it takes to construct, to maintain, the milling and paving, the expansion of lanes. That's a subsidy on cars. Imagine if in New York City they tried to build roads to move 20 million people around. They couldn't do it. You absolutely would bring that city to a standstill. And so we're the third largest state in all of America, and we're growing every single day. We've got to start building 21st century transportation to include light rail and high-speed rail to move people throughout the length and the width of this state. New York City, one of the best well-used public transportation systems, does not turn a profit, right? But it absolutely alleviates and allows for that city to run seamlessly because you're putting people on rail and moving them around.
Let me ask you, though, a lot of people who are in the middle on a lot of these political issues, they're not necessarily ideological, but they vote with their feet.
Yeah.
They move from blue states like New York that are expensive, that have crumbling infrastructure, that are high tax states, to red or purple states like Florida, because they like the low cost of living, the more stringent public expenditures. And they might look at a candidate like you and say, I like what he's saying, but I don't want my taxes raised. I don't want my tax dollars being spent on a lot of projects that may or may not pan out. What do you say to that voter?
Well, listen, we can't have it both ways. We cannot be a state where we want to be a state leader in education and in transportation and in environment and not be willing to make those investments, right? First of all, I'm not proposing a tax on everyday Floridians. The tax conversation that we have been about the 3% of the wealthiest corporations in this state paying their fair share. We pay our fair share as everyday citizens. I'm taxed at the grocery store, at the gas station, and my real estate taxes and my ad valorem taxes. Everyday people are paying their fair share, but corporations also have to pay their fair share. And if we all come together and pay our fair share, and we have a governor and a government that is interested in investing in what it means to build the kind of state that people want to choose to locate in, not just to retire. We love retirees, but we want to attract the kind of companies that say, if I move my employment base to Florida, or if I move my jobs to Florida, can I recruit the talent? Is Florida's education system producing the kind of worker that I could then hire and then begin to build and grow my business? And unfortunately, there's a reason why we don't have more cities shortlisted for Amazon in this state. We got everything that we need, except Amazon wants to know, what's the transportation system look like? How are they dealing with climate change? What if my employees move here? Will they have to expend additional money putting their kids in private school because the public school is such a failure? Those are real decisions. So if we're talking about building the economy of this state, we've got to be able to invest in those very basic kinds of services that make the kind of state that people want to choose to locate in.
When you think of the pillars of the Florida economy, traditionally it's been described as tourism, agriculture, and development.
Yeah.
You're describing, it seems to me, a future Florida economy that's not built on those pillars.
No.
What would you build the economy on then?
Well, I think, first of all, by dealing with the environment, I believe that there are green jobs in dealing with the environment. The same week that Donald Trump pulled out of the Paris Accord in my city, we broke ground on a 120-acre solar farm. I believe that we ought to be looking at the future of energy in this state. Florida should be leading on these issues. We should be teaching the rest of the 49 states and, frankly, the rest of the world how to build a state that's more resilient in the face of climate change. If we decide to make investments into high speed, imagine the contractors, the engineers, the construction workers, the designers, the architects that go to work strengthening this state's infrastructure. If we decide to invest in education, where we right now have the lowest starting salaries for teachers, imagine what that does to this state's economy. So I actually believe that the future economy of this state is built in addressing the challenges that confront this state. There's nothing that cannot be fixed about this state that's going wrong, that can't be fixed by what's going right in this state. And what's going right is that we've got the opportunity to elect leaders who have a vision and an understanding of where this state has to go. And quite frankly, I'm willing to put in the work to get us there.
He is Andrew Gillum, outgoing mayor of Tallahassee, one of the candidates on the Democratic side of the ballot for Florida governor. The primary is Tuesday, August 28th. You'll be appearing tonight in downtown Jacksonville at a fundraiser, I believe.
Yes.
So thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me. I enjoy the conversation.
Much more still ahead. We'll be right back. Let go, drop in.
Robert, you know what I love about your show, Planet Money?
What?
Planet Money, on the surface, is a show about economics, but really it's a show about how the world works.
And Guy Raz, what I love about How I Built This is that it's about entrepreneurs, but it's really about people who have dreams, who face crisis and loss and success.
Well, now you can hear
Planet Money
and How I Built This together in 1 hour, and I'm pretty sure this is going to blow your mind.
Or crack it open a bit.
Sunday at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
Hi, this is Chris Thiele. This weekend, live from here, we'll be coming to you from the Town Hall in New York City with Spoon.
Do I have to talk you into it? Do we have to make sense of it? I want to whisper down the tube all the words you will never use. Do I have to talk you into it?
Also, Cecile McLaurin-Salvant and comedian Carmen Lynch. Plus, duets with Sarah Jarosz. All this and more right here this weekend.
Saturday at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, as arguments continue to rage over whether to remove Confederate statues and monuments in this area, our occasional commentator Jay Solomon finds himself with a new point of view on the issue. He explains in this edition of With All Due Respect.
I've read a lot of Civil War history, most centered on the big picture and names like Lincoln, Grant, and Lee. My feelings about Confederate monuments have frankly been somewhat ambiguous, but recently I encountered a local Confederate sailor. His story makes me think. I was part of a presentation on interesting people buried in Jacksonville's historic Evergreen Cemetery on the north side. My subject, James Hamilton Toombe, Savannah-born in 1839. He was 13 when his family moved here. His father built a steam-powered sawmill, and James took to the steam engine like a teen today with an Xbox. So by 1861, as the Civil War approached, he had the credentials to be a marine engineer. James passed his exams and was appointed assistant engineer in the U.S. Navy, but was torn by conflicting loyalties to both the Navy and the South. The war started, he chose the South, entered the new Confederate Navy, and was soon in action. His abilities and bravery were noticed. James was selected for a desperate effort to break the Union blockade of Charleston Harbor. He and three others boarded a small craft called the David, a semi-submersible secret weapon designed to attach torpedoes to enemy ships. On an October 1863 night, they targeted the most daunting warship in the Union Navy, a 14-gun ironclad, the New Ironsides. Despite hostile fire, they rammed the big ship, causing a huge explosion, damaging but not sinking the Ironsides. However, the displacement of water from the blast created a gusher that drowned the David's engine. Ordered to abandon ship, James started for shore, but backtracked to the David, got the engine restarted, and sailed away, saving the boat for later attacks. It was considered a victory for the Confederates and the first ever successful torpedo attack on a major warship. James survived the Civil War, eventually came home, and entered private business. He had three sons who, interestingly, all became U.S. naval officers. Two retired as captains, the third died while on duty in the Atlantic during World War I. At Evergreen Cemetery, tombstones for James and family show no indication of Civil War service. Close by, a simple engraved stone pylon memorializes the shipmates who dared confront the Ironsides. James Toombe is an historic figure. Can we begrudge him the tribute to brothers in arms? It's a much different memorial than those causing controversy now. No stars and bars, a cemetery setting, not a public square. His remembrance isn't designed to threaten or hurt the hearts of people of color. James clarified that position for me. History is important. Belatedly erecting grand shrines to those central to an illegal rebellion distorts history and deters healing even 150 years later. Robert E. Lee agrees. Multiple times he spoke against Civil War memorials. He said, "I think it wiser not to keep open the sores of war, but to follow the example of those nations who endeavored to obliterate the marks of civil strife and to commit to oblivion the feelings it engendered." With all due respect, I'm Jay Solomon.
Jay Solomon is a retired broadcast executive and WJCT volunteer. In a moment, the 50th anniversary of the Mandarin Art Festival. That's next.
A1A Solar designs and installs residential and commercial solar electric systems. NABCET certified A1A Solar provides sustainable and financially efficient energy solutions. Learn whether solar is right for you with a 5-question quiz at a1asolar.com.
The Alhambra Theater and Dining presents Five Guys Named Mo, featuring a live jazz band. When our hero hits a bad patch, Five Guys Named Mo appear from his radio to sing and dance his blues away. Show opens April 4th. Tickets at alhambrajacks.com.
YouTube launched in 2005, and it's come a long way from that Charlie Bit My Finger video. Billions of people watch its content. The platform has the power to influence, amuse, astound, and at times, horrify. Who's really watching? And what do its top creators think about the site today? A closer look at YouTube, next time on 1A. Weekdays at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Fresh Air, another story that relates to the Mueller investigation. Mueller has gotten the cooperation of George Nader in return for immunity. Nader has been a political advisor to the Crown Prince of the United Arab Emirates and worked with Republican fundraiser Elliot Broidy to get access to President Trump. We'll talk with New York Times reporter David Kirkpatrick. Join us. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Violence in video games is again getting a lot of attention given real-world problems.
When I see the fact that we have to keep explaining and re-explaining what we do and what our craft means and all of these kind of different issues, that's us not doing a good enough job helping reach out to the public.
I'm Kai Rizdal. How far is too far with video games? Next time on Marketplace.
Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, finally, this hour, it is the longest running festival of its kind anywhere in town, and it's happening this Easter weekend. Come on out Saturday and Sunday to the Mandarin Art Festival as dozens of local and national artists exhibit their work. Show manager Kristen Bennett is here now with a preview. Hey, Kristen.
Hi, Melissa.
And happy 50th anniversary.
Thank you so much. That's
a big milestone.
It is a big milestone for an event of this type. You know, I am not from Mandarin myself, and I was brought on board with this wonderful group of volunteers who commit all of their time to planning this festival. And it's been a lot of fun for me to really get to know Mandarin and historic Mandarin and all the work that's gone into bringing this community event.
This has been held every Easter weekend in Mandarin since 1968. It was founded, I'm looking at the website, by Judge Westbury, for whomever remembers him, and a group of local artists. This is a juried fine art event. Thousands of people will be coming out for this.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I learned that, you know, Mandarin in the 60s was very rural, full of citrus plantations, and it was also known as an artist enclave. So there are some artist legends, Memphis Wood, Charlie Brown, who used to get together and have these salons of sorts, and they started tossing around the idea of having an art show that for just Mandarin artists. Mm-hmm. And they took it to Judge Westbury, who was the president of the Mandarin Community Club at the time, and pitched it as a fundraising idea for the club. And the show was born. And so it's just grown from there. We'll have 117 artists this year. About 25% of them are from North Florida, but all over the state and as far as Connecticut, Pennsylvania, Louisiana, all over.
This is a way for people to invest in art and also be part of, it sounds like, a really nice community event. There's going to be all the fun stuff, bake sale, prize drawings, children's art show, Easter egg hunt. Well, I guess Easter egg hunt this year?
No Easter egg hunt. You know, they stopped that a few years ago, which is unfortunate. I think it would be so fun. And we get the question a lot from people who say, you know, why do you do this on Easter weekend? But they've always done it on Easter weekend from the beginning. And so we actually get, you know, Sunday ends up being a fun day for families. There are a lot of multi-generational families who'll come out and you'll see mom, daughter, grandmother walking around the festival and they've done it for years and
this
years.
This is a family tradition.
Absolutely.
There's a green market too. What's that all about?
There is. So locally made consumables, a lot of vendors like you would see at the Riverside Arts Market. And they're in Billard Commemorative Park, which is in the back of the property at the community club. And that's all wrangled by my dear friend and artist, Julie Fetzer, does a great job with the green market.
Now, for people who are new to art collection, can they afford some of the art. That's always a barrier, I think, for people that don't have more money to invest in this.
I think the artists these days understand that. And so many of the artists will have original work, which, of course, will be more expensive. But then they'll also bring prints and things that people can purchase as an introductory and a variety of price ranges. And so there's paintings, sculptures, pottery, photography, a lot of jewelry artists. Jewelry artists are the thing now.
Really?
We actually had to cut them off at one point. We didn't see many jewelry artists. But that's a big draw. A lot of people love to come see the really artistically crafted jewelry there.
Okay. And so hopefully nice weather for this. I always say from Easter, right after Easter, straight through Halloween, it's hot in this part of the country. But hopefully Easter weekend will be lovely.
Right now, we have glorious weather. We have our fingers crossed for the artists loading in tomorrow. May have a little difficulty, so you all send some good vibes out to them in their setup day tomorrow. But it should be a beautiful weekend in Mandarin.
It's an Easter weekend tradition in Mandarin. The 50th anniversary of the Mandarin Art Festival, both Saturday and Sunday. Just go to MandarinArtFestival.org for more. Show manager Kristen Bennett. I can't think of a better person to be the showrunner for this thing.
Thank you, Melissa. It's fun to be back in the mix, actually.
Yes,
it is.
Indeed.
I've been a hermit for a little bit, but it's fun to be back.
Yeah. And you used to run the Riverside Arts Market, so you know what you're doing, lady.
I try.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board during the hour. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. 1A's up next as a former prosecutor explains why the public will likely be left in the dark once special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation wraps up. That's coming up next. And if you're listening to our rebroadcast tonight, stay tuned for music. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow with our Friday Media Roundtable. See you then, and have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.